Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Future of Work podcast. My name is Rick Sammons, and I'm the ILO's Director of Research and Representative to the G20 Finance Ministers and Central Bank Governors process. In my recent book, Human-Centered Economics: The Living Standards of Nations, I examine the chronic underperformance of economies with respect to social inclusion, environmental sustainability, and human and systemic resilience. And I present a new approach to macroeconomic theory and policy to better address these issues, which are likely to become more urgent in light of a number of new and complex challenges that our world is facing, like artificial intelligence and climate change. In today's episode, we'll explore how fit for purpose the standard approach to macroeconomics is in the 21st century with the preeminent economic historian and macroeconomist, Lord Robert Skidelsky, who is Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at the University of Warwick, member of the British House of Lords, and author of many books, including the definitive three-volume biography of John Maynard Keynes. Lord Skidelsky, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for asking me.
At the outset of our conversation, I suppose we should acknowledge that monetary and fiscal policy were deployed to considerable effect during the COVID crisis to stabilize economies and sustain people's jobs and incomes. But economics as an intellectual discipline is clearly struggling to address a number of ongoing vexing challenges, like inequality, underemployment, precarity, and environmental degradation. Progress has been extremely slow toward the related objectives countries unanimously agreed to in the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Climate Agreement. And this is contributing to a certain social pessimism about whether capitalism can ever be made sufficiently inclusive and sustainable. How do you assess the state of the field, Lord Skidelsky? Is macroeconomics, in your view, or at least the mainstream practice of it, stuck or suffering from some sort of blind spot? And if so, how do we begin to transform it to deal more effectively with the distributional and other social justice challenges likely to be exacerbated by the technological, environmental, and other big challenges we're witnessing today?
Well, I do think one of the things that's happened is that macroeconomics, the great contribution of Keynes, has been squeezed out of economic pedagogy, not entirely squeezed out of policy, as you rightly pointed out. But it's been squeezed out of pedagogy. And as a result, all economic problems that arise are discussed in terms of microeconomics. In other words, in terms of supply, the supply side of the economy, the demand side of the economy is on the whole ignored, except, as you say, in an emergency when you have unexplained collapses of demand, often attributed to government failures of one kind or another, and then you supply a plaster, and you just try to keep the patient alive for a bit until the automatic forces of recovery come in. So I think that's the state of the pedagogy. It's economies have an automatic tendency to full employment, whatever the distributional their distributional state, that can be upset from time to time, usually by government interference, but then with some appropriate emergency treatment, the normal course of events will be resumed. In that scenario, distribution doesn't really play a role. The distribution of wealth and incomes is a sort of separate issue in microeconomics. I mean, in other words, it may affect issues of justice. It may certainly affects politics and social elements of social stability. But it's not part of any economic model. In other words, you can't find in economics any very clear statement of a correlation between certain types of distribution and economic performance.
Yes, the current paradigm is focused almost exclusively on optimizing the quantity of growth, or GDP, as opposed to the social quality of growth, which is to say broad improvement in people's living standards and well-being. Policy often amounts to a dash for growth, as measured by things like GDP statistics and asset prices, on the assumption that the social benefits of growth, such as the availability of decent work with an adequate living wage, improved access to and affordability of basic necessities, and greater economic and environmental security, will inevitably diffuse or trickle down to the population as a whole. And yet the most influential early theorists and codifiers of liberal political economy, including Adam Smith, didn't assume this. They didn't see overall progress in social welfare as an inevitable outcome of economic growth. Rather, they quite explicitly viewed economies through two and equally important lenses. First, production in the markets and capital accumulation that enable it, on the one hand, and distribution and the policies and institutional features that enable it, on the other. For example, in such areas as labor rights, social and environmental protection, corporate and financial governance, infrastructure, taxation, education and skilling, etc. It's actually the combination of the two that's needed to achieve the bottom line purpose of economics, which is to improve the material well-being or living standards of a society as a whole. In my book, I try to resurrect this institutional dimension and give it a clearer and more actionable structure, because I believe it's becoming ever more important to satisfying the rising demands of people for social and environmental justice in this century. In fact, many countries learned and applied this lesson after the Great Depression in the middle decades of the 20th century. But this more balanced view of economic progress has gone lost in the contemporary pedagogy and practice of macroeconomics, hasn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I think you know, one of the absurdities of our time is the view that by reducing the tax burdens on the very rich opens the door to paradise for everyone else. That is absolutely crazy. What it does is it simply makes the rich richer. It doesn't. The trickle-down effect is not very, very large, and empirically it's not well established. And what's more, when you look at the data, as you say, the fastest rate of period of growth in the global economy, I mean, especially in the West, in the Western countries, in history, has been was in the 30 years after the end of the Second World War, when the highest marginal rates of tax were 90%, and it was literally impossible for anyone in that world to become a billionaire. I mean, there weren't any billionaires. There were very, very few millionaires. That was a period of very fast growth, relative to what happened, and social consensus was high. There were strong unions, and all right, it ended, you might say, in tears, but for 30 years, something worked. And it worked for welfare, it worked for society. And that's broken down. And if you ask why it's broken down, it seems to me economics or economic pedagogy, as you called it, has a great deal to answer for, because it's repudiated the kind of activism and the institutional structure which was in place.
Thank you, Lord Skidelsky. Keynes himself did not focus directly on distribution. He didn't pick up on Marx's and Hobson's arguments about high inequality fueling underconsumption and thus undermining growth in a country's available fiscal resources, which are partly a function of economic growth. You've suggested in a recent article that more often than we think, there is unexploited policy space on the fiscal front. And you've made this case in the context of the current debate in the United Kingdom over fiscal policy. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think Labour and the left more generally is in a bind about economic policy, because on the one hand, they don't accept the view that economies are under the existing regime performing at their best capacity, either in terms of output or level of output or quality of work. They want to use the budget constructively in order to expand the economy and also to improve the quality of economic activity. In other words, to improve productivity. But they're trapped by the assumption that economies have no spare capacity, that they are at full employment, and they can point to figures showing that unemployment is, headline unemployment is a very low rate. And therefore, the question they can't quite answer is where they're going to get the money from to run the kind of policy they want. Because there's no capacity to further capacity to squeeze out of the economy to do it. They have to take the money from somewhere, and therefore that means higher taxes. And therefore the left are really pinioned by the charge that to do what they want will simply mean raising taxes, and raising taxes will slow down the rate of growth, whereas the counter-argument is that the way to get faster growth, and faster growth per person, is to lower taxes. It is very interesting that the Chancellor, our Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, in introducing his budget a couple of weeks ago, explicitly referred to the Laffer curve. I mean, I don't think many people nowadays use the Laffer curve, but this was the idea that if you lower taxes, you increase the growth rate and therefore the revenues of the state by getting people to work harder. I mean, this was a very popular doctrine in the 1980s and 90s, and it's sort of led a sort of quiet life ever since. And now it's revived. Suddenly, there it is to justify a policy of tax cuts without having to raise taxes at a later time. So I think the left can't invoke Laffer, they can't invoke Keynes, and therefore they're stuck with fiscal orthodoxy. And this means that, in fact, Rachel Reeves has abandoned the pledge to spend several hundred billion over the 5 years on a green investment. That's just been dropped because the Conservatives said, where are you going to raise the money? And she can't say part of the money, or a lot of the money, will come from the economic growth that this fiscal expansion will bring about.
Your new book, The Machine Age, is a fascinating look at humans' relationship with technology over the years, with a particular reference to today's debate about artificial intelligence. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the net effect of this technology on our economies? And what do you think it all means for the field of economics going forward?
I mean, one view is quite simply that machines are liberating. If you take the view, which is a standard economics view, and even Keynes had this view, if you take the view that work is a cost or disutility, and it's the cost of living, basically, then of course anything that lowers the cost of living must be a benefit, and machines lower the cost of living. They make the output of the society available at a much lower price. Therefore, that means people can, in theory, get what they want in terms of their basket of their consumption basket of goods and services at a lower cost than they would if they didn't have the machines, and therefore they will need to work less and less to get what they want. And so the Keynesian paradise, if you like, or that particular paradise opened up by his Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, a short essay he wrote in 1930, was that by now we would only have to work 3 or 4 hours a day to, as he put it, satisfy the old Adam in us. In other words, to regain the Garden of Eden. So that's that view of things. But of course, that assumes two things. One is that distribution will ensure, or distributive policy will ensure that the fruits of technical progress are widely diffused through society and don't all accrue in one corner of it. And secondly, that people gladly give up work. What are they then going to do if they only have to work a few hours a week? Work gives people, I think, a sense of identity. It's a way of connecting with their fellows. And there are better jobs and worse jobs, of course. So that path If you take that route, you're not so sanguine about the progressive potential of machines. So there's a conflict here, and that conflict has gone on actually ever since the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, here at the ILO, we have done a preliminary estimate of the likely implications of generative AI on job automation, which is replacement of jobs by technology, as opposed to job augmentation, which is when workers use the technology to become more efficient and productive in their existing work. Globally, we found that about 13% of all jobs are considerably exposed to augmentation, and 2.3% or so are exposed to automation. So that's 6 times more jobs likely to be transformed than replaced. While that may sound reassuring at first, this amounts to somewhere between 10 and 20% of the workforce facing a major transition of some sort over the next 10-15 years, either having to find a new job or having to upskill in order to keep pace in their current occupation. That's a big increase in dislocation and adjustments for workers. And it will take place at the same time that countries are supposed to be deepening their green transition in industry and energy systems, which along with rising temperatures and sea levels are likely to disrupt many other jobs. Change in labor markets of such a large magnitude has major implications for fiscal policy and the social contract more generally. That's to say, for the role of governments and enterprises in supporting people through these disruptions to their lives. You would think it would also have major implications for the field of economics, wouldn't you? For the way that we think about growth and development.
There's much more churn, much less security, and therefore, if you leave the development of technology to the market and don't actually ask the questions of what it means for human welfare and what it means for being human, you're going to end up in disaster. And the trouble is, we don't consider that. We just assume, as crudely as this, that anything that eases the burden of work must be good. And the only thing is that we need to think about is if we're humane people, is how to provide people with the incomes to live with their redundancy. And I think that's a very dangerous position to be in. I think it's going to be a potential cause of big social unrest. Lots of people are feeling that they're being put on the scrap heap, and that they have no future. Younger people are notably more pessimistic than their parents and grandparents about the future. And I think it's partly to do with this question, what are we going to do with our lives? And I think, all right, this is a developed country problem. It may not be nearly as big a problem yet with in the developing world. But it's going to come sooner or later, because what we're doing is we're pressing technological change on everyone. It's a free good.
Yes, there seems to be quite a bit of soul searching taking place among mainstream economists today. This is creating space and political demand for new thinking and fundamentally different approaches. In this podcast, we've explored some alternatives to the dominant economic thinking that can help to re-embed the teaching and practice of macroeconomics in society, from being very tightly focused on GDP growth to applying itself much more directly and holistically to improving the general standard of living, the everyday lived experience of people. I hope that our discussion today has given our listeners a glimpse of what a more human-centered, that is to say, inclusive, sustainable, and resilient approach to economics would look like. Lord Skidelsky, on behalf of the ILO, I'd like to thank you very much for joining this edition of the Future of Work podcast.
It was a great pleasure to be on the program. Thank you.
And I'd like to advise our listeners that links to the publications we've mentioned can be found on the podcast website.